Larry opens the door and tells me it's time for breakfast, so I leave, and I follow him and Warren and John to the dining hall, and I get in line, and I get some food. I find an empty table, and I sit down, and I begin eating a bowl of warm, sugary oatmeal and drinking a glass of water. The feelings have subsided, but not entirely. I think that I'm going insane. I finish my oatmeal, and I sit back in my chair, and I look around the dining hall. And I see Ken talking to a man from my unit. The man points to me, and Ken walks over to my table, and he sits down across from me. "You feeling all right?" "I'm fine." "Have you done any thinking about our conversation?" "Yeah." "Any conclusions?" "No." "Keep thinking, then." "I will." "You have an appointment this morning with the dentist." "All right. I'll walk you up to the medical unit, and after you get your meds, I'll take you to a van. The driver will take you to your appointment, wait for you, and bring you back." "Okay." "Then after you have lunch, we're going to have you take a test called the MMPI. It's a standard psych test that will give us some insight as to how we can help you." "Okay." He stands. "You ready?" I grab my tray and I stand. "Yeah." I put my tray away and we leave, and we walk back to the medical unit. I get my pills and I take them, and we go to the front entrance of the hospital, where a white transportation van sits waiting. Ken gives me a jacket so I won't be cold, and we go outside, and he slides open the side door of the van, and he talks to the driver while I climb into the front seat and make myself comfortable. Ken says goodbye, and I say goodbye, and he shuts the door, and the driver starts to drive, and we pull away. The weather has gotten worse. Black clouds fill the sky, and patches of snow gather along the ground. What once was green is brown. What once had leaves now has none. It's cold, and it's winter, and the world has gone to sleep. I stare out the window at the drifting, frozen landscape. A mist from my breath collects itself on the glass, and I begin to shiver. I huddle up, and I look at the driver, who is also huddled up, and is driving slowly and watching the road. "You think we could get some heat in here?" The driver looks over at me. "You cold?" I return his look. "Goddamn right I'm cold." He laughs. "It's coming, kid. Once the engine is warm, we'll be warm." We stop at a lonely intersection where the light is red and the roads are empty, and the wind sends scraps of paper and leaves whipping through the air. The driver looks ancient. He has messy white hair and a messy white beard and bright blue eyes. His skin looks as if it's made out of leather. He has thin forearms, but they look strong, and despite his age, he looks strong. He reaches out to shake my hand. "I'm Hank." We shake hands.
"I'm James."
"What happened?"
"Don't exactly know."
"You fucked up?"
"What's it look like?"
"Looks like that might be an understatement."
"Looks are not deceiving."
We laugh and the light turns green, and Hank continues driving, and we continue talking. He's from Massachusetts, where he spent most of his life as the captain of a commercial fishing boat. He was always a drinker, but after he retired, it got worse. He lost his house, his wife, his family, his mind. He came here to get help, and after he got well, he decided to stay and see if he could help others. He's an easy talker, and as the ride drags on, I begin to think of him as a friend. We drive into a small town and turn onto what seems to be its main street. There's a grocery store, a hardware store, and a police station. Halloween decorations hang from the streetlights, and people who all seem to know each other wander in and out of the shops. Hank pulls into a parking spot in front of a bait and tackle store, and we get out of the van and we walk to a small door next to the main entrance of the store. Hank opens the door and we walk up a flight of stairs, and we go through another door and we enter a small dark room with two couches, a sliding glass reception area, and a small table littered with magazines and children's books. Hank heads to the reception desk, and I walk over to one of the couches, and I sit down, and I begin looking through the magazines. On the other couch, a woman sits with a young boy looking through a picture book about Babar the elephant.
When I find a magazine and I lean back to start reading it, I can see the woman watching me out of the corner of her eye.
She moves closer to the child and she puts her arm around him, and she leans over and kisses his forehead. I know why she does it, and I don't blame her. And as I open my magazine, my heart breaks, and I hope that the little boy doesn't grow up to be anything like me. Hank comes back from the reception desk.
They're going to take you right now.
I set down the magazine, and I stand.
Okay.
I'm scared, and Hank can see it.
You all right?
He puts his hand on my shoulder.
Yeah.
He looks me straight in the eye.
I know this is a podunk town, but these people know what they're doing, kid. You're gonna be fine.
I look away. A nurse calls my name, and Hank moves his arm, and I walk toward an open door where the nurse waits for me. Before I go in, I turn around, and I see the woman and the child staring at me. I look to Hank, and he nods, and I nod, and for a brief second, I feel strong. Not strong enough to face myself, but strong enough to keep going. I walk through the door, and the nurse shows me to a clean, white room, and I sit down in a large dentist's chair in the middle of the room, and the nurse leaves, and I wait. A few seconds later, the dentist walks in. He's in his 40s, and he is tall, and he has dark hair and dark eyes and rough skin. Except for the white coat and the clipboard, he looks like a lumberjack.
You're James?
He pulls up a chair and sits in front of me.
Yes.
Dr. David Stevens, nice to meet you.
We shake hands.
You too.
He puts on a pair of thin, clear latex gloves.
I got some info on you from the doc at the treatment center.
He grabs a small flashlight from his pocket.
But I need to check you out more myself, see what exactly we've got going on here.
He leans forward.
Can you open your mouth?
I open my mouth, and he turns on the flashlight, and he moves toward my face.
Can I lift your upper lip?
I nod yes, and he sets down the flashlight, and he lifts my lip, and he picks up a long, thin metal tool with a sharp end.
This might hurt.
He touches the shards of my outer teeth with the end of the tool, and he starts pushing into some of the damaged areas of my gums. The pain is instant, sharp and overwhelming. I want to close my mouth and make him stop, make the pain go away, but I don't do it. I close my eyes and ball my hands into fists, and I squeeze. I can feel my lips quivering, and I can taste blood, and when the dentist touches my teeth, they move. He finishes the exam, and I hear him set the tool in a tray. I lean back, and I open my eyes.
We need to do some x-rays, but from what I can see with my eyes, we're going to have to do some surgery.
I squeeze my fists, squeeze tight.
The outer two teeth are broken, but the roots seem to be intact.
My lips quiver.
We can cap those, and you should be fine.
I can taste the blood.
The front two, though, are dying.
I run my tongue along my upper gum.
We're going to need to do root canals and build a bridge.
I feel the remains of my teeth. Short, sharp shards of teeth.
It won't be pleasant, but unless you're comfortable without teeth, it's the only option.
I nod.
I'll set up an appointment for you in a few days. The swelling in your lips should be gone by then, and we can't do this until it is.
I nod.
Nice to meet you, James.
Nice to meet you, too.
He stands, and we shake hands, and he leaves. Another nurse comes in, and she washes out my mouth, and she stuffs it with cotton wads and plates, and she takes some x-rays. When she's finished, the cotton wads are covered in blood, and my mouth feels as if it's been brushed with sandpaper and slammed with a hammer. She tells me I can go, and she leaves, and I stand, and I walk back into the lobby. Hank is sitting on one of the couches reading a magazine about the personal lives of movie stars. And I walk over and I sit down next to him, and he sets down the magazine, and he looks at me.
How'd it go?
It was fine.
They gonna fix you up?
They say they are.
I'm gonna go find out when you gotta come back.
He stands, and he walks to the reception area, and he talks to the receptionist, and he comes back, and we leave the office, and we get in the van and start driving back to the clinic. Hank tries to be friendly and talk to me, but I tell him my mouth hurts, so he leaves me alone. I stare out the window. I think about her. I think about the first time I saw her. I was 18 and at school, and I was sitting by myself under the orange and yellow of a fading October tree. I had a book in my hand, and I was reading, and for some reason I looked up. She was walking alone across the lawn of the school, with an armful of papers. She tripped, and the papers fell to the ground, and as she bent over to get them, she looked around to see if anyone had noticed. She didn't see me, but as she scrambled to pick up her papers, I saw her. She didn't see me, but I saw her. The van pulls up to the entrance to the clinic, and Hank and I get out of the van. And I walk over to Hank, and I thank him for driving me and helping me. He tells me I look as if I could use a hug, and I laugh at him. And he ignores me and steps forward and puts his arm around me and hugs me. I warm at the simple pleasure of human contact. And for the first time in a long time, I actually feel good. It makes me uncomfortable, so I pull away, and I say goodbye, and I thank him again, and I walk back into the clinic. The receptionist tells me it's lunchtime, so I go to the dining hall, and I get in line, and I get a bowl of soup and a glass of water, and I find an empty table, and I sit down by myself, and I do the best I can to force some food past the bloody wreckage of my mouth. "Hey, kid." I look up. A man stands across from me. He's about 50, medium height, medium build. He has thick brown hair that is thinning on top, and a weathered face that looks as if it has taken a few punches. He's wearing a bright blue and yellow silk Hawaiian shirt, small round silver glasses, and a huge gold Rolex. He stares at me. He sets his tray down. He looks pissed. "Remember me?" "No." "You've been walking around the last 2 days calling me Gene Hackman. Now, I know they got you doped up on that detox shit, but I'm not Gene Hackman. I've never been Gene Hackman, I'll never be Gene Hackman, and if you call me Gene fucking Hackman again, we're gonna have a big fucking problem." I laugh. "Something funny?" I laugh again. He looks like Gene Hackman. "You think this is funny, you little fuck?" I stare at him and I smile. I have no teeth and the thought makes me smile more. "You think this is fucking funny?" I stare at him. He has hard, angry, violent eyes. I understand his eyes, and I know how to deal with them. This is familiar territory. I stand, and my smile disappears. I stare at the man, and the room becomes quiet. I speak. "I don't know you. I don't remember ever seeing you. I don't remember ever speaking to you, and I certainly don't remember ever calling you Gene Hackman. But if I did, yeah, I think it's funny." I can feel that most of the people in the dining room are watching us, and my heartbeat increases, and the man stares at me, and his eyes are hard, angry, and violent. I know I'm in no shape for this, but I don't care. I feel myself getting ready. I tense up, clench my jaw, stare straight ahead, eyes fixed, focused, and unblinking. "If you're gonna force me to beat your ass, old man, we might as well get on with it." He's shocked. Not scared or unwilling, just shocked. I stare straight ahead. "What did you just say?" Eyes fixed, focused, and unblinking. "I said, if you're gonna force me to beat your ass, we might as well get on with it." "What's your name, kid?"
"James."
"James? I'm Leonard." He smiles. "I don't know if you're the stupidest fuck I ever met or the bravest, but if you answer one question for me, I'll consider letting that last remark slide."
"What's the question, Leonard?"
"Are you fucked up, James?"
"Yeah, Leonard, I'm fucked up. I'm fucked up real bad."
"Good, 'cause I'm fucked up too. I like fucked up people, and I try to associate with them as much as I can.
Why don't we sit and have lunch together? See if we can forget about our differences and become friends. I could use a friend in here.
All right.
We sit and we eat our lunches, and Leonard talks, and I listen to him talk. Leonard is from Las Vegas, and he has been here for a week. He's addicted to cocaine and has been planning his stay here for over a year. For the last 12 months, he's done nothing but eat rich food, drink expensive wine, play golf, and snort enormous amounts of blow. He has done enough, he says, that if he does it again, he will die. I don't know what he does for a living, but I know it's not legal, and I know he does it well. I can see it in his eyes, hear it in his words, recognize it in the easy way he speaks of things most people would consider horrific. I am comfortable with Leonard. More comfortable with him than anyone else whom I have met in here. He speaks easily of horror. He is a criminal of some sort. I am comfortable with him. We finish eating, and we put our trays away, and we leave the dining room, and we go to the lecture hall. Female patients sit on one side of the hall, males on the other, and the total number of patients is around 250. Everyone sits with their unit. And as Leonard and I sit down among the 20 men of Sawyer, a doctor on a stage starts speaking to us about the concept of alcoholism and addiction as a disease. I start to feel sick. Waves of nausea pulse through me. I get cold. I close my eyes and I open them, and I close them again. I do it quickly. I do it slowly. I start to shiver and I stare at the seat in front of me, and it's moving. It starts to talk to me, so I look away, and I see blue and silver lights dancing everywhere. I close my eyes, and the lights dance through my brain. I can feel my blood crawling slowly through my heart, and I think I'm going to pass out, so I grab my face with one of my hands, and I squeeze my face. It hurts, but I want the pain because it makes this nightmare a reality, and it keeps me from going insane. The pain is immense, but I need it because it keeps me from going insane. The doctor finishes speaking, and the patients start clapping. And I let go of my face, and I take a deep breath, and I stare straight ahead. Leonard taps me on the shoulder.
You all right?
No.
You need some help?
No.
You look like you do.
I need something, but it's not help.
As the doctor on stage answers questions, I stand and I walk out of the lecture hall. I head back to the unit hoping to make it to my bed, and hoping that my bed will make me feel better. As I walk by Ken's office, he calls for me, and I ignore him, and I keep walking. He comes into the hall, and he calls for me again.
James!
I stop.
What?
I lean against the wall.
You all right?
He walks toward me.
I feel like shit. I need to lie down.
He stops in front of me. You can lie down later. It's time for your test.
What test?
The MMPI. I told you about it this morning.
I don't want to take it.
Why?
Because I feel like shit and I need to lie down.
You're going to feel like shit for a while.
Maybe. But I still don't want to take your test.
It's not optional.
I can't take it later.
No, we need you to take it now. It helps us know how to help you, and we want to start helping you right away.
Fine.
We walk past the lecture hall and through a maze of carpeted corridors, and we enter a small, bare, white room with two chairs and a table. Ken sits down, and I sit down. On the table in front of us is a large, stapled booklet and a form answer sheet and a pencil. Ken speaks. It's a very simple test. All of the questions are true or false. You can take as long as you want to answer them. When you're finished, come back to my office, and if I'm not there, leave your responses on my desk. A staff psychologist will analyze everything, and in 2 days we'll go over the results together.
All right.
Any questions?
No.
Ken leaves, and I grab the pencil and the answer sheet, and I open the booklet and I start reading it. The pages are filled with questions, and I begin answering them. I am a stable person.
False.
I think the world is aligned against me.
False.
I think my problems are caused by others.
False. I don't trust anybody. False. I hate myself. True. I often think of death. True. Suicide is a reasonable option. True. My sins are unpardonable. I stare at the question. My sins are unpardonable. I stare at the question. My sins are unpardonable. I leave it blank. I finish 566 of the 567 true or false questions of the test, and I close the booklet, and I lay down my pencil, and I take a deep breath. Hours have passed, and I am exhausted, and I want a drink. Vodka, gin, rum, tequila, bourbon, scotch, I don't care, just give me a drink. A nice, strong, alcoholic drink. I tell myself that I only want one, but I know it's not true. I want fucking 50. I grab my answer sheet and I stand, and I leave the room, and I walk back to Ken's office, and I leave my test and my answer sheet on his desk, and I walk into the unit. The day's activities are done, and the men are spread out in small groups across both of the levels. They are playing cards, talking shit, smoking cigarettes, and drinking coffee. The phone is free, and I haven't talked to my parents, my brother, or any of my friends. So I walk down to the lower level, and I grab a chair, and I sit down by the phone, and I pick up the receiver, and I start making collect calls. I call my friend Amy. I call my friend Lucinda. I call my friend Courtney. They were all originally her friends, but when she left and everybody else left, they stood with me. I love all three dearly, and the conversations upset me. I call, they answer. I tell them that I got hurt, that I came here, that I'm going to try to get better. I tell them I don't know if I can. They cry and they ask me if I need anything, and I tell them no. They ask if they can help in any way. I tell them they've given me enough. We hang up. I call my brother. He asks me how I am, and I tell him that I'm holding up. He tells me that he's worried about me and that he wants to come and see me. I tell him I don't know what today is, but that visiting day is on Sunday, and I'd like it if he came. He tells me to be brave, and I tell him that I'm trying. He tells me that he's proud of me, and I say thanks. I tell him I need to go, and he says to call if I need anything, and I thank him. We hang up. I call my parents at a hotel in Chicago, and my mother answers the phone. Hello? Hi, Mom. Hold on, James. I hear her call my father. My father picks up the phone. Hi, James.
Hi, Dad.
How are you?
All right.
How is it there?
It's fine.
What's happened so far?
I'm being detoxed, and that sucks. And yesterday I moved down to a unit, and that's been fine.
Are you feeling like it's helping?
I don't know.
I hear my mom take a deep breath. Anything we can do? I hear my mom break down.
No.
I listen to her cry.
I gotta go, Dad.
I listen to her cry. You're gonna be okay, James. Just keep it up. I listen to her cry.
I gotta go.
If you need anything, call us.
Goodbye.
We love you. I hang up the phone and I stare at the floor. And I think about my mother and my father in a hotel room in Chicago, and I wonder why they still love me, and why I can't love them back, and how two normal, stable people could have created something like me, lived with something like me, and tolerated something like me. I stare at the floor, and I wonder, how did they tolerate me? I look up, and I see most of the men leaving the unit to go to dinner. So I stand, and I walk through the halls to the dining hall, and I get in line, and I get some soup and a glass of water, and I sit down at an empty table and I eat. The food tastes good, and when I finish my bowl, I want more. My body is craving and wanting and requiring, and though it can't have what it normally has, it needs something. I get a second bowl, and then a third, and then a fourth. I eat them all, and I want more. It's always been the same. I want more and more and more and more.
I finish eating, and I leave the dining hall, and I go to the lecture hall, and I sit with Leonard, and I listen to a woman tell her life story. The woman has been to 17 treatment centers in the last decade. She lost her husband, her kids, all of her money, and spent 2 years in jail. She's been clean for 18 months and says she's happy for the first time in her entire life. She says she's devoted her life to God and to the 12 steps and that each new day is better than the last. Good luck, lady. Good fucking luck. She finishes her story and people clap, and I stand and I go back to the unit and I go to my room. I want to go to bed, but I can't, so I play cards with John and Larry and Warren. Larry, who has a wife and newborn twin girls waiting at home for him in Texas, is grief-stricken. He found out this afternoon that he has the HIV virus, which he probably contracted during 10 years of mainlining crystal meth and fucking whores. He wants to tell his wife, but he's scared to call her, so he sits with us and he plays cards, and he talks about how much he loves his children. I want to try to comfort him, but I don't know what to say. So I say nothing, and I laugh when he makes jokes, and I tell him his girls are beautiful when he shows me their picture. It gets late, and we put away the cards, and we get into our beds. My body still wants what I cannot give it, and I'm unable to sleep, so I lie on my back and I stare at the ceiling. I think about where I am and how I got here, and what the fuck am I going to do? And I listen to Larry cry and pound on his pillow and curse God and beg for forgiveness. At a certain point, my eyes close, and at a certain point, I fall asleep. I sit alone at a table. It's dark, and I don't know where I am or how I got here. There are bottles of liquor and wine everywhere, and on the table in front of me is a large pile of white cocaine and a huge bag of yellow crack. There is also a torch, a pipe, a tube of glue, and an open can filled with gasoline. I look around me. There is blackness. There is alcohol. There are drugs. There is an abundance of all of them. I know I'm alone, and there is no one to stop me. I know I can do as much as I want of whatever I want. As I reach for one of the bottles, something inside of me tells me to stop, that what I'm doing is wrong, that I can't do it anymore, that I'm killing myself. I reach anyway. I grip the bottle, bring it to my lips, and take a long, deep draw that burns my mouth, my throat, and my stomach. For the briefest instant, I feel complete. The pain I carry with me disappears. I feel comfortable and at rest, confident and secure, calm and composed. I feel good. God damn it, I feel fucking good. The feelings are gone as quickly as they came, and I want them back. I don't care what I have to do, what I have to take, what I have to endure. I'll do anything. I just want them to come back. I take another drink. It doesn't work. I grab a different bottle, take a larger drink. It doesn't work. I seize bottle after bottle, take drink after drink. Nothing works. Instead of feeling better, I feel increasingly worse. Everything I felt that was good has become bad, and it has been magnified beyond any point of reference or comprehension. My only option is to try and kill what hurts. Kill it. I switch to the drugs. I take a deep breath and I bury my face in the pile of coke, and I inhale, and my nostrils turn to fire, and the back of my throat becomes an inferno. I take a breath, inhale, take a breath, inhale, take a breath, inhale. Too much, too fast, and my nose starts bleeding. I wipe the blood away, and I take a breath, and I inhale. I do it again. The killing has started, but I am not close to being done. I rip open the bag of crack, and I pull out a handful of small yellow rocks. I wipe the blood again, and I snatch the pipe, which is a long, straight piece of glass and a screen filter, and I start stuffing rocks into it. I fill it, wipe the blood again, fire up the torch, put the pipe in my mouth, bring the white flame to its tip. I inhale. Hot peppermint honey mixed with napalm, followed by a rush 1,000-fold stronger than the purest powder, 1,000-fold more dangerous. I hold, and the rush gains speed and power, and it grows, consumes, and overwhelms me. I feel good again.
perfect, magnificent, and invincible, like the power of every orgasm I've ever had, could ever have, and will ever have, has been concentrated into a single moment. Oh, my God, I'm coming. Oh, my fucking God, I'm coming. Let it come, let it come, let it come, let it come, let it fucking come!
It's gone as fast as it came, and I know it's gone for good. Replaced by fear, dread, and a murderous rage. Any pretense of experiencing pleasure disappears. I grab rocks, stuff the pipe, hit. I grab rocks, stuff the pipe, hit. The torch is white and the glass is pink and I feel the skin of my fingers bubbling, but it doesn't bother me. I grab rocks, stuff the pipe, hit. I do it until the bag is empty and then I stuff the bag into the pipe and I smoke the plastic. I have a murderous rage and I need to kill. Kill my heart, kill my mind, kill myself. There is glue and there is gasoline and I want them both. I grab the glue, and I put the end of the tube below my nose, and I lay a thick line on the skin between my nostrils and my lip. Each breath brings the stench of hell and death. Each breath brings on the desire for more. I am killing quickly and efficiently now, but not quickly or efficiently enough. I lean over and place my nose just above the shimmering surface of the gasoline, and I stare into the face of chemical annihilation. This face is my friend, my enemy, and my only option. I take it. Breathe in, breathe out. Go faster and faster and faster and faster. I don't feel anything anymore, or what I do feel is so powerful that my mind and my body are incapable of allowing it to register. I am comfortable here. This is what I want, what I need, and what I must have, and this is where I have been living the last few years of my life. I realize that I'm cold, and I snap, and I open my eyes. The room is dark and quiet. A clock near John's bed reads 6:15. I can hear Warren snoring. I sit up and I rub my body and I shiver. Goose pimples cover my arms, and the hair on the back of my neck stands straight and I'm scared. Scared of my dream. Scared of the morning. Scared of this place and the people in it. Scared of a life without drugs and alcohol. Scared of myself. Scared to deal with myself. Scared of the day that lies ahead. Scared shitless. Scared out of my mind. I'm scared and I'm alone and it's early in the morning and no one is awake yet. I get out of bed and I walk to the bathroom and I take a shower and I dry myself off and the pain hits me and I drop to my knees and I crawl to the toilet and I get sick. The sickness is worse than usual. Thicker, bloodier, more chunks of stomach, more painful. Each wrenching ejection burns my throat and sends a sharp pain through my chest and makes me feel as if I'm choking. It makes me feel as if I'm choking, and I almost wish I was because then it would stop. I just want it to stop. The sickness ends, and I sit down on the floor and I lean back against the front of the toilet. Waves of emotion begin streaming through me, and I can feel the welling of tears. Everything that I know and that I am, and everything that I've done begins flashing in front of my eyes. My past, my present, my future, my friends, my enemies, my friends who became enemies, where I've lived, where I've been, what I've seen, what I've done, what I've ruined and destroyed. I start to cry. Tears begin running down my face, and quiet sobs escape me. I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't know why I'm here, and I don't know how things ever got this bad. I try to find answers, but they aren't there. I'm too fucked up to have answers. I'm too fucked up for anything. The tears come harder, and sobs become louder, and I curl up on the cold tile floor, and I hug myself. I hug myself, and I wail, and it's morning, and I'm somewhere in Minnesota. And I haven't had a drink in 5 days, and I don't know what the fuck is happening to me. The tears stop and the sobs stop, and I sit up and I wipe my face. I can hear talking outside, and I don't want to be seen this way, so I stand up and I take a deep breath, and I tell myself I'm all right, and I leave. I walk into the room. Warren and John are standing by Larry's bed. Warren hears me, and he looks over at me.
Have you seen Larry?
No.
His stuff is gone.
I haven't seen him.
We think he left.
I don't know what to tell you.
We're going to find the counselors to tell them. If you see him, will you send him after us?
Yeah. They leave, and I walk to my bed, and as I put on my clothes, I think about Larry. He's gone. Definitely gone, and definitely not coming back. He's out, alone in the cold, probably on the side of a highway, carrying his bags, his thumb out and raised. He's thinking of his wife and his beautiful little girls. He wants to see them and hold them and hug them and kiss them. He wants to tell them he's sorry and that everything is all right, that he's ready to be the husband and the father he knows he could have been. He's praying that they don't have what he has because if they do, they're dead. Maybe not tomorrow or next week or next month or next year, but sooner or later, they're dead. And they're dead because of him. Bless you, Larry. My thoughts are with you. May you make it home safe. May your wife and daughters be HIV negative. May the rest of your days on this earth be the happiest you've known. Bless you, Larry. Bless you. I finish dressing, and I leave the room. I collect the cleaning supplies, and I go to the group toilets. And though they don't seem dirty, I get down on my knees, and I start cleaning them.
Hey.
I turn around. Roy is standing at the door.
You did a shitty job yesterday.
I lay down my sponge.
What?
I stand.
You did a shitty job yesterday.
Roy steps forward.
They looked clean to me.
He steps forward again. They were dirty. Do a better job today, or I'm telling on you. The bathroom is small.
You hear me? You clean these toilets well, or I'm telling on you.
I feel trapped.
I'll clean them well, I promise.
Like a rat in a cage.
You'll clean them better than well. You'll make them sparkle, or I'm getting you thrown out.
Like a rat in a cage who wants to get out.
Get the fuck out of my face.
He steps forward again. I can smell his breath, feel his spit on my cheeks. The fury rises.
I'll get you thrown out of here on your fucking ass, you little shit.
I reach up and I grab Roy by the throat and I squeeze, and I throw him against the wall of the bathroom and he hits with a thud and he starts screaming,
Help! 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 Help!
I grab him again and I shove him through the door. He hits the wall outside the door and he slumps to the ground and he continues screaming,
Help! 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 Help!
I step through the door and I stand over him. How clean are the toilets now, motherfucker? I want to beat him.
Help! 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 Help!
I want to kick his fucking face in.
How clean are the toilets now, motherfucker?
I want to tear his limbs off and stuff them down his fucking throat.
Help! 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 Help!
I want to kill him. Reduce him to crushed bone, torn flesh and blood.
How clean are they now, motherfucker?
Fucking kill him.
How clean are they now? Help! 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 Help!
Two men rush into the hall, and they grab me, and they pull me back. I push them away.
Don't fucking touch me!
More come. They lift Roy to his feet, stand between us, stare at me as if I'm a monster. I stare back. I stare through them and straight at Roy.
He attacked me! He's crazy! Get him away from me!
Roy is crying and sobbing. Tears are streaming down his face, and he's breathing quickly and heavily. The men try to comfort him.
I came to help him with the toilets. I just wanted to help, and he attacked me. I didn't do anything wrong.
They stare at me. Stare at me as if I'm a monster. I turn and I walk back to my room, and it's empty. And I begin pacing, and my body shakes, and I try to control myself. Half of me wants to go back to the hall and fight whoever is there, and either destroy or be destroyed. Half of me wants to hide. All of me wants the liquor and the wine and the coke and the crack and the glue and the gasoline that I had in my dream. The fury has risen. I pace and I shake and I try to control myself. I need to calm down, but I don't know how. The outlets I depend on, use for survival, and have become addicted to are gone.
replaced by doctors and nurses and counselors and rules and regulations and pills and lectures and mandatory meals and jobs in the morning, and none of them do a fucking thing for me. Not one fucking thing. I stop pacing. I stare at the floor. I ball my fists and I squeeze, and every cell in my body tenses and prepares. And it's coming. The fury is coming, and I don't know what to do or where to go or how to stop it. And it's coming, and it's coming, and it comes. Explosion. I scream. I see a bed. I grab the end of the bed and I lift it and I flip it, and the mattress goes, and I grab the simple metal frame and I lift it and I throw it down with everything, 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 and it snaps. But it's not enough, so I stomp it, stomp it, stomp it, and it snaps again, 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 and there are only broken bars and bolts and screws, and I'm screaming, and it feels good, and I'm just getting started. I move to a nightstand. I pull out the drawers and throw, and they're on the other side of the room, and they're no longer drawers, but pieces of drawers, and the nightstand is still there, so I pick it up, and I slam it, and it's just pieces of a nightstand. There is someone by the door, and that someone is yelling, but I don't hear him. I am beyond hearing, beyond sight, beyond feeling, beyond thinking. I am deaf, dumb, and blind. Unconscious, unaware, and uncontrollable. There is a dresser. There are pieces of a dresser. There is another bed, and I flip it, and I destroy it. There is more yelling, and then there are men in white, and there are arms, and they're holding me, and I'm screaming. There is a needle. I am in a new room. It is simple and white and empty, but for a bed. I don't know how I got here or how long I have been here or what day it is or what time it is. I do know that I'm still at the clinic. I know this because I can hear the screams. The screams of the addicted without their addictions. The screams of the dead, who are somehow still alive. I lie on my back and I stare at the ceiling. I have been sick twice today, but it wasn't bad. There was no blood and no bile and no chunks, just acid and water. I find this encouraging. It is the only thing about my current situation that I find encouraging. I am waiting for someone to come and tell me that it is time for me to leave. I am trying to decide what I am going to do. I have no place to live, nowhere to go. I have no money, no resources, no job. I have no hope for money, no hope for resources, no hope for a job. I have no self-confidence, no self-esteem, no sense of self-worth. My sense of self-preservation was gone a long time ago. I won't bother with my parents or my brother or the few friends I have left. They will write me off once I leave here. I will write me off once I leave here. There is a knock at the door, and I ignore it. There is another knock, and I ignore it again. I don't want to see anybody, or speak to anybody, or have anything to do with anybody. I need to decide what I'm going to do. The door opens, and Ken and a man and a woman walk in, and I sit up. The man is taller than Ken, and his body is thick with muscle, and he has short, black, spiky hair. He wears large black boots, faded black jeans, and a black shirt that has a picture of a Harley on the front and reads, "Ride hard, ride sober." His arms are covered with tattoos, and his knuckles are covered with scars. The woman is short and plump, and she has long gray hair pulled into a ponytail, and she looks like Mona Lisa. She wears thick, baggy clothing and wool socks and Birkenstocks, and she wears silver rings on her fingers and a turquoise pendant around her neck. I see no tattoos, and I see no scars. Ken speaks. "Hi, James."
"Hi."
"Mind if we sit down?"
"I don't care."
Ken sits on the end of the bed. The woman sits cross-legged on the floor. The man stands. Ken speaks. "This is Lincoln." He motions to the man. The man stares at me. "He's the unit supervisor on Sawyer." I stare back. "And this is Joanne." Lincoln stares at me. "She's a staff psychologist." I stare back. "We'd like to talk about what happened yesterday." Lincoln stares. I stare back. "Then talk." Lincoln speaks. His voice is deep and hard. Sounds like a rusty metal spike.
"We want you to talk. We want to hear your side of things."
"You gonna throw me out of here?"
Ken looks at Lincoln. Lincoln looks at Joanne. Joanne speaks.
Right now, we just want to talk.
Where should I start?
Lincoln speaks.
Where did the trouble start?
I had a dream, a bad dream, and it completely fucked me up. I guess it started there.
Ken speaks. What was the dream?
I was in a room alone, and I didn't know where I was or how I got there, and I was drinking and doing drugs, and I got annihilated. It seemed real, and when I woke up, I was scared.
Joanne speaks.
You had a user dream.
What's a user dream?
When alcoholics and addicts stop drinking and using drugs, their subconscious minds still crave them. That craving is sometimes manifested in dreams that can seem startlingly real, and, in a sense, are real. Although you didn't use, some part of your mind did. You'll probably continue to have them for as long as a year.
That'll be fun.
Lincoln speaks.
Then what?
He's staring at me.
I went to the bathroom, and I got sick, and I felt worse. I tried to look at my face, and I got sick in a different way, and I felt worse again. Then I went to clean the toilets.
He's still staring.
And then you attacked Roy.
I turn, stare back.
Roy got in my face.
I got him out of my face. Ken speaks.
Why'd he get in your face?
No idea.
He just did it?
He's been giving me shit the whole time I've been here. I have no idea why.
What's he been doing?
Telling me I'm breaking all the rules, telling me I'm doing everything wrong, telling me he's going to get me thrown out of here.
Lincoln speaks.
And you don't like that, do you?
I didn't do anything. He had no right to say shit to me.
And did you have any right to attack him?
Once he got in my face, I did.
What if I got in your face?
I'd get you out of it.
Lincoln stares.
The tough guy act isn't going to get you very far.
I stare back.
Won't get you very far either.
Ken speaks.
Roy told us he was helping you and you went after him without a reason.
Roy's a fucking liar.
Lincoln speaks.
Watch your mouth. Fuck you. What did you say?
I said fuck you.
Watch your mouth. Fuck you.
Ken speaks.
Calm down, James.
Fuck you too, Ken.
Joanne speaks, looks at Ken and Lincoln.
Would you leave us alone for a while?
Lincoln speaks.
We're not done yet.
Joanne speaks.
I think it would be best if you left us alone for a little while. We'll talk as a group again soon.
Lincoln turns and walks out of the room without a word. Ken looks at me and he speaks.
If you need to talk, I'll be in my office.
He follows Lincoln out and he shuts the door, and I'm alone with Joanne. She leans against the wall and she closes her eyes and she takes a deep breath and she exhales. And I sit on the bed and I watch her, and she just sits there and she breathes, and I get tired of the silence and the sound of her breathing. I want to be alone, and I need to figure out what I'm going to do. I speak.
What do you want?
She opens her eyes.
Just thought I'd sit with you for a few minutes, see if there was anything you wanted to talk about.
There's nothing.
Okay.
She stands.
Is there anything I can help you with before I leave?
Yeah.
What?
I want to stop taking Librium.
Why?
It makes me crazy. Makes me feel like everything is a bad fucking dream.
I'd rather have nothing than that shit. I'll tell the nurses to end your cycle.
Thank you.
Anything else?
What am I supposed to do?
Today is another day. Breakfast starts in about 10 minutes, then the lecture. You have an appointment with the dentist at 10:30, and need to be back here to meet the driver at 10 o'clock. Just go about your day, and if you need to talk about anything, I'm in room 312.
Thank you.
She moves toward the door.
I'll see you soon?
Maybe.
She leaves, and I'm alone,
and I'm surprised to be here, and part of me is relieved, and part of me is disappointed, and part of me is confused, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I can either leave or stay. I can either leave or stay. Leaving means going back to addiction and facing either death or jail. Staying means leaving addiction and facing something that is unknown to me. I'm not sure which scares me more. I get up and I open the door, and I see I'm in the medical unit. I get in line and I start to go about my day, and I remember Joanne's room number, 312. I take my antibiotics, and they go down easier than they have been going down, and I walk through the clean, bright, empty halls to the dining hall. As I enter the glass corridor, I see that I'm late, and I see people look up and stare at me, and I ignore them, and I get a bowl of gray, mushy oatmeal, and I dump a large pile of sugar on top of it, and I find a place at an empty table, and I sit down. I know that people are still staring at me, and I ignore them. Leonard motions to me, and he walks over with two men. The first man is short and thick and wears a black bandana around his head. Long, dark hair hangs out of the back of the bandana. He wears jeans and a black T-shirt and has a scar running the length of one of his cheeks. The other man is tall and thin and wears tight black jeans, a black button-down shirt, and black cowboy boots. His face is tight and drawn, and blue veins stick out from beneath the skin of his arms. Both of the men look violent and angry. Both of them are far more frightening than the average patient here. Leonard sets his tray down on my table.
"Hey, kid."
"Hey.
This is Ed," he motions to the short man. "And this is Ted,"
he motions to the tall man. The men nod. I nod back.
"Mind if we eat with you?"
"I don't care." Leonard sits down.
"Thanks."
Ed and Ted follow his lead. Leonard speaks.
"Heard you beat Roy's ass yesterday."
I stare at my oatmeal. I don't respond. "I hate that asshole. So don't worry about me telling anybody anything." I look up at Leonard. I don't respond. Ted speaks. He has a deep southern accent.
"You should have seen him afterward. He was fucked up, all crying and moaning and screaming and shit. He got so scared he pissed his pants."
I look at Ted. I don't respond. Ed speaks. His voice is low and worn, a blue-collar voice.
"What did you do to him?"
I look at Ed.
"I ain't gonna say nothing to anybody."
I look at the scar. It's deep and brutal.
"I just want to know what you did to him."
I asked him if the toilets were clean enough, pushed him around a bit. Leonard speaks.
"That's it?"
"Yeah, that's it."
I stand and I pick up my tray and I walk to an empty table and I sit down and I start eating. The oatmeal is gray and mushy and disgusting, but the sugar tastes good. It soaks into my tongue, and its sweetness is the first taste I have recognized aside from whiskey or wine or smoke or vomit since the evening of my accident. I like the sweet, and the taste means that some of my senses are coming back. They will all come back if I stay here. I'll be able to taste and smell and experience normal sensations that normal people experience every day, if I stay. I shovel the last sweet spoonful of oatmeal into my mouth, and as I swallow it, I can feel my stomach trying to send it back up. I clench my jaw, and I hold my breath, and I squeeze my abdominal muscles, and I try to stop it. I start gagging, having small, violent, painful heaves. I feel a mass move up my throat, and it no longer tastes so sweet, and I take a breath and I swallow again, and the mass moves back down. As soon as it is down, it tries to come back up. I repeat the process. Clench, squeeze, breathe, swallow. Clench, breathe, squeeze, swallow. My body is fighting what it needs to get better. I am fighting what I need to get better. The mass finally settles, and it's uncomfortable. And I take a deep breath, and I lean back in my chair. My stomach is full and burning. It's not used to keeping so much food
and it's not used to keeping so much food so regularly. It feels as if it's stretching, and it begins draining me of all of my energy. The simple act of digesting a bowl of oatmeal is draining me of all my energy. I have been awake less than an hour. Around me, the other patients are filing out of the dining hall and heading to the lecture. I stand and I put my tray away, and I follow them down the glass corridor, and through the maze of halls, and past the streaming windows, and the open doors, and the smiling faces of the staff. I look at no one, and I acknowledge no one. I'm in my head, and in my head I'm alone. I'm trying to decide what I'm going to do. I find a seat among the men of my unit and I sit down. There is nobody on either side of me, and that is the way I want it. It is also the way the men of the unit seem to want it. I can feel them looking at me, and when I look back, they look away. They look away quickly, and I stare at them until they can feel me staring, and they can feel the message behind my stare, and they know not to look at me anymore. They don't look at me anymore. Roy is sitting two rows in front of me, and is whispering to a man I don't know, and he is leering at me out of the corner of his eye. I stare at him. His whispering becomes more animated, and is accompanied by angry gestures. The man starts leering at me. Roy punctuates a sentence, and they start laughing. I am in no mood. Hey, Roy. Roy stops talking, stares at me. Is there a problem? The rest of the men of the unit stare at me. No, there's no problem. If you've got something to say, come say it to my face. I don't have anything to say. Then why don't you and your little butt buddy shut the fuck up? Roy gasps. The man is shocked. I hear several people laugh. I stare at Roy until he and the man turn around. They look straight ahead, and there is no more whispering. A woman steps onto the stage, and the lecture starts. The woman talks about sex and addiction, and how alcoholics and addicts often have cross-addictions between their drug of choice and their sexual activity of choice. She talks about how the connection can drive both activities to dangerous and deviant places, physical places and figurative places, places without exits and places from which it is impossible to return. The lecture ends, and I sit and I wait, and I watch everyone leave. And I stand and I walk out, and the food is still soaking in, and the last remnants of the past day's Librium are seeping out. I feel heavy and slow, but beneath there are the beginnings of something fast and needy and scared and shaky and fragile and anxious and angry and desperate. For now the heaviness is holding it back, but I know that it's only for now. I go back to the medical unit, and I find a nurse, and I tell her I have to go to the dentist, and she checks the outside appointment book, and it checks, and she sends me to a waiting room, and I wait. The waiting room has windows, and I can see outside. Though it is late in the morning, it is still dark. I can hear thunder and see sleet. The wind is whipping whatever lies on the ground into the air. The trees look as if they want to hide. It is ugly, and it's going to get uglier. Hank walks into the waiting room. He's bundled in a thick, warm, waterproof jacket. He wears wool-lined rubber boots. Hey, kid! Hey, Hank. We shake hands. How you been? Been better. I stand. Bet you been worse, too. I smile. Yeah, I've been worse, too. You ready? Yeah. Let's go. We walk out of the waiting room and through a short hall and outside. The van is 20 feet from the exit, and I run toward it. The sleet and the wind pound into my skin. The thunder shakes my bones. I open the front passenger door of the van, and I jump inside, and the van is running, and it is warm. There is an old weather-beaten jacket similar to the one Hank is wearing sitting on the seat. I pick it up and put it on, and settle in and clutch myself. After a few seconds, Hank, who did not need to run, opens the driver's door and climbs in. You found the coat. It was hard to miss. I used to wear it when I worked on my boat. It has that look.
It's a good coat.
It's working great right now.
I know you don't have one, or have anything, from what I'm told, so I want you to use it while you're here.
Thank you, Hank. I appreciate that.
Don't mention it.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Don't mention it.
Hank puts the van into gear, and we pull away from the clinic, and we start making our way toward town. Hank concentrates on the road, and I stare out the window, and I think. A few days ago, the land was shutting down and preparing for winter and dying. Now it's shut down and prepared and dead. There are no leaves on the trees, no living vegetation on the ground, not an insect or a bird or an animal in sight. The thunder is getting louder and closer, and the sleet is getting harder and faster, and the wind is trying to push the van into a ditch. Hank keeps it on the road. I stare out the window, and I think. I knew the facts within a month of first laying eyes on her. She was from Connecticut. Her father was a prominent investment banker in New York. Her mother played tennis and bridge, and was the president of the local junior league. She had gone to a prestigious all-girls prep school in New Hampshire. She had an older brother and an older sister. She had never had a boyfriend. I met her when a friend of mine asked me if I could get him some dope. He wasn't a smoker, so I asked him who wanted it, and he told me it was for a girl named Lucinda, who lived in his dorm. And I told him I would have to meet her first, so he gave me the room number, and I went to the room, and I knocked on the door, and the door opened, and she was standing there, tall and thin, long blonde hair, like thick ropes of silk, eyes cut from the Arctic. I didn't know Lucinda, and I didn't know she lived with Lucinda, and I couldn't speak, and she was standing there. She was standing there.
Hi. I just stared. Can I help you with something?
I started to open my mouth, and my mouth didn't work, and my heart was pounding, and my hands were shaking, and I felt dizzy and excited and scared and insignificant. She was standing in front of me, right in front of me. Tall and thin, long blonde hair like thick ropes of silk, eyes cut from the Arctic. I turned and I walked away without a word. I didn't look back, and I went to my room, and I got a strong bottle and I took a strong drink. My heart was still pounding, and my hands were still shaking, and for the first time in my life, it wasn't because of alcohol or drugs. And for the first time in my life, alcohol and drugs wouldn't make it go away. We pull into town. And it is empty. There are no parked cars, no shoppers, no young mothers walking with children, no old men on benches with coffee and words of wisdom. The stores are open, but they're not doing business. The only things out are thunder and sleet and wind. They are getting stronger. We park in the same spot in front of the same building, and Hank turns off the van and reaches over and opens the glove compartment, and removes two old yellow tennis balls. He hands them to me.
I thought you might want these.
Why?
I don't know much about anything except for fishing and driving, but I have a feeling whatever you're getting done this morning is going to hurt.
Probably.
You're not going to get painkillers or anesthesia, at least not while you're still a patient at a treatment center. I've found the next best thing is those balls. When it starts hurting, start squeezing.
I hold the balls in my hand. Give them a squeeze.
Thanks. Sure.
He opens his door, and he gets out. And I do the same, and we shut the doors, and we walk into the building, and we walk up the stairs to the dentist's office. The door is open, and we go inside, and I sit on one of the couches in the waiting room, and Hank goes to reception, and he starts talking to the receptionist. The Babar the Elephant book is sitting in front of me. I pick it up and start reading it. I remember reading it as a small boy and enjoying it and imagining that I was friends with Babar, his constant companion during all of his adventures. He went to the moon. I went with him. He fought tomb raiders in Egypt. I fought alongside him. He rescued his elephant girlfriend from ivory hunters on the savannah. I coordinated the getaway. I loved that goddamn elephant, and I loved being his friend. In a childhood full of unhappiness and rage, Babar is one of the few pleasant memories that I have. Me and Babar, kicking some motherfucking ass. Hank comes back and he sits down next to me.
They're ready for you.
All right.
You ready for them?
I hold up the tennis balls.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what you look like with teeth.
It'll be interesting to have them again. I stand. I'll see you in a while, Hank. Thanks for everything.
Don't mention it.
I walk toward a door where a nurse stands waiting for me. As I walk past her, she is careful not to touch me, and I am brought back from the happy afterglow of pachyderm memories, and I am reminded of what I am. I am an alcoholic, and I am a drug addict, and I am a criminal. I am missing my front four teeth. I have a hole in my cheek that has been closed with 41 stitches. I have a broken nose, and I have black swollen eyes. I have an escort because I am a patient at a drug and alcohol treatment center. I am wearing a borrowed jacket because I don't have one of my own. I am carrying two old yellow tennis balls because I'm not allowed to have any painkillers or anesthesia. I am an alcoholic. I am a drug addict. I am a criminal. That's what I am, and I don't blame the nurse for not wanting to touch me. If I weren't me, I wouldn't want to touch me. She leads me into a small room. The room is like many other rooms I have been in lately, except that it seems cleaner and whiter. There are stainless steel cabinets along the walls, trays of sharp, sparkling instruments on top of the cabinets, a large halogen lamp hanging from the ceiling. There is a surgical chair sitting in the middle of the floor. It is metal, and it has green cushions and long, menacing arms and all sorts of straps and buttons and levers and gears. It looks like a medieval torture device. I know it is for me. I walk past the nurse and I sit down in the chair, and I try to make myself comfortable, but it's not possible. Torture devices are not made to be comfortable.
Dr. Stevens will be here in a minute.
All right. Can I get you anything while you wait?
A Babar book.
Excuse me?
I would like a Babar the Elephant book. You have them in the waiting room.
I'll be right back.
Thank you.
She leaves, and I'm alone, and as I settle into the chair and look around the room, I start to panic. The last of the Librium is nearly gone, and the food in my stomach has been broken down to the point that it no longer holds and everything speeds up. My heart, my blood pressure, the thoughts in my head. My hands are shaking, but it is not the heavy shaking of withdrawal. It is a quick and fragile form of shaking, a form of shaking that comes from fear. Fear of this room, fear of the chair, fear of what the cabinets hold, fear of what the instruments do, fear of what's going to happen to me here, fear of a pain so great that I need to squeeze tennis balls to make it go away. The nurse returns with the Babar book, and she gives it to me, and she leaves. I set the tennis balls in my lap, and I open the book, and I try to read it. As I turn the pages, I can see the words and I can see the pictures, but I can't read the words, and I can't understand the pictures. Everything is speeding up.